Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. Welcome to Listen to Older Voices and part two of a three-part program featuring Murray Robertson. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves and it's a pleasure to host this program where we unwrap more of the life and times of musician and electrical engineer draftsman Murray Robertson. Last week we learned that Murray's mother was a gifted classical pianist and, as a result, it was classical piano that Murray took up. However, we also learned that the big band swing music really captured his interest and he moved away from being a potential classical pianist to actually joining one of Australia's most iconic instrumental bands of the 1950s and 1960s, the Thunderbirds. Yet, while still playing five gigs a week, Murray also became a qualified aircraft electrical engineer, which stood him in good stead in later years. This week, we learn how the Thunderbirds became the support and backing band for an amazing tour of US artists that included Roy Orbison and Dion DiMucci, whilst also becoming the backing band for many Australian artists such as Johnny Chester and Marcy Jones. As the 1960s progressed, Murray played less but became active in the studio where he undertook music direction, particularly for Merv Benton and Johnny Chester. There's a lot more to tell of Murray, including life in the 1970s, where he'd moved away from his career with the Thunderbirds and developed out his non-music career. But we now pick up with Murray talking about the work the Thunderbirds and he had to do whilst preparing for the visiting US rock and roll tour.
We as a band were able to learn and put together the backing for all those guys before they got here, because we knew what their hit songs were because they were familiar. We had recordings of them when they were played on the radio. But not only that, we had a genius in the band named Charlie Gould.
You say he was a genius. Well, that manifest. I mean,
he joined the Thunderbirds when he was 17, and he'd come from Scotland on a boat, and I think he played guitar in Scotland before he came over. He was a gifted musician without ever having been taught.
So he picked things up very quickly.
He just knew what to do and did it very well. I mean, he ended up being the principal guitar player in the ABC show band for 23 years.
Well, that doesn't come easy.
He was the go-to guy for Georgie Fame when he came out here with his famous Flames.
Right.
Charlie Gould was his guitar player.
Okay.
Every time he came here, and he was good. So, and he was one of two gifted musicians I had the privilege to play with in the Thunderbirds. The other was Graham Lyle.
Right. Well, no.
Who ended up being the musical director for Channel 9. And is now, I believe, a director of the James Morrison Music School in South Australia. So I was extremely lucky to be associated with those two players.
So you would have been basically learning all the time.
Because
look at the people you're working with.
Learning all the time.
Yes. You must have been chuffed as an individual and as a group of musicians when you were told that you were doing this tour.
Yeah, I think the guys were that competent, they took it in their stride.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, there was no time to be amazed or...
It was just happening.
Whatever, we just, I guess we've got to do this, so let's do it.
Is it a fair question or is it a stupid question to say to you, were there any highlights of that tour? Or was the whole thing just a highlight?
Oh, well, I know Roy Orbison was amazed at our ability to play songs when he came out here, because he walked out, we had a rehearsal, and he walked onto the stage and said, well, this is the set I'm going to do. Do you know this stuff? And we said, well, yeah, well, we just play it. But one of the concerts, he threw a song at us cold. He says, I'm going to do I Got a Woman. Can you play that? Yeah, okay, bang. And we all just went, because we knew it. We'd listened to all his stuff.
Yes.
But I Got a Woman was a Ray Charles song,
right,
before Roy Orbison got hold of it or performed it. So, I mean, Ray Charles has been, I suppose you could call him an influence, but one of my go-to people to listen to. And he's one of the biggest influences on modern music that I can think of, actually.
Festival Hall.
Yeah, yeah, well, the concerts were there, Festival Hall in Melbourne, on the rotating stage at the festival on, was it called Festival Hall? The stadium in Sydney, a rotating stage.
Yes, that's how the rotating.
And Brisbane. Stage. We did the East Coast, that's one.
Let's talk about Festival Hall, because that's the one I know more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
A hall or a venue that had many, many brilliant acts there. As a musician, was it a good place to play?
Well, I mean, it's so vastly different now, it's hard to even think of that what was going on then was even feasible. But as a piano player, I was playing instruments with the microphone stuck inside the piano. I have no idea how I was being heard, or above guitars and electric basses. By today's standards, the amplification in the play was very crude.
Mm.
But it worked. The Thunderbirds did a support, because Johnny Chester was one of the singers that the Thunderbirds were associated with, even in his performances, and all his early recording career was all done backing by the Thunderbirds at W&G.
Johnny Chester! I couldn't sleep at all last night. Just thinking of you. Then don't wait around all night. Cause I was burning and burning, burning and falling. The dark and dirty all night. Kick a blanket on the floor. Turn myself upside down. I never felt like it before. Bed, turned on the light, pulled down the shade, went to the kitchen for a bite, rolled up the shade, turned off the light, jumped back into bed, it was the middle of the night, the clock downstairs was striking four, I couldn't get you off my mind.
But we did a support for Fabian at a concert in Festival Hall.
Another big name.
Yeah.
So, did you ever get to the point where you just took it for granted audience responses because it was so happening so often? I mean, these people you're playing with, apart from the Thunderbirds being a big name in Melbourne, you would have always had a great reception. Did you get to the point where that just became another day, or was it always?
No,
did it always affect you positively?
I can't think of anybody I work with who took it for granted. For me, it was always, we've got to do this to generate that sort of response, because if we don't, we won't get the response, and that'll be the end of you. I mean, you can never take this sort of thing for granted. I don't think even today I couldn't say I did that.
Yeah. Come the early to mid-60s, around 63, 64, Australia's hit with basically a tsunami of sound and music coming from Britain. Although the roots of it were from America, significantly different sound. How did the Thunderbirds adapt to that? Because stylistically, it was a little bit different to what you'd been doing. Did you adapt, or did you just keep going?
I left the band in 62. I travelled overseas for a couple of years and came back. And I didn't really play a lot in the 70s and 80s. I think I wasn't impressed all that much with English rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
I think, for better or worse, my influences were ingrained in the development of American jazz and swing, and I found it hard to deal with. I mean, the Beatles were a different story altogether, because they generated a whole lot of music that was out of left field and out of the pocket and branded themselves with their own music.
So you didn't play a lot of music in the 60s?
No. Oh, the 60s, yeah, but later on, the 70s and 80s, I didn't, until I joined a band called the All Stars in Melbourne here, and we played a lot around Melbourne and, again, supported a lot of singers. And during the early 60s, I did a lot of recording with the Thunderbirds, and also did the musical direction for the recordings of Merv Benton at W&G.
Okay.
most of his songs I'm either playing on or was there.
Some boys say they love your eyes. I heard some boys say they love the way they just hypnotize. Oh, honey, I don't know what it is you got. All I know is that you got what it takes to take what I've got. Some boys say they love your walk. I heard some boys say just the other day they love your sweet baby talk. Oh, honey, I don't know just what it is you've got. All I know is that you've got what it takes to take what I've got.
Listen to older voices, the magic of memories. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Murray Robertson. And Murray is talking about the transition of his music career through the 1960s and into the 1970s.
And I can remember Johnny Chester brought up this song called Shy Away, and he wanted some strings, some violins on it. So I wrote a chart for the violin backing, and Lindsay, the engineer at W&G, his wife worked at, I think it was the Methodist Ladies' College.
Right.
And we had to have a string section for this song, so I go in there and got six or eight teenagers from the Methodist Ladies' College who was going to make up the string section for this recording. And I thought, oh, okay. I didn't have much influence over who was going to play at the time.
And it sounds like not a lot of faith it was going to work.
No, and I don't think it did all that well because their intonation could have been a bit better. But anyway, that was, as far as I know, it was the first pop record that was in Melbourne that was made with something other than a basic rock band.
Right.
And that leads to the development of some songs that Merv Benton wanted to do that required a brass section, which was right up my alley. And those recordings were done outside of the W&G studio for the first time. They were done for the W&G label but not recorded in the...
In their studio.
Yeah, the studio was in South Melbourne. A well-known studio whose name just escapes me at the moment, but
near where the Grand Prix and everything is,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
It'll come to both of us sooner or later.
Bill Armstrong studio,
of course.
That's the one.
Of course.
It's Bank Street, is it? Anyway, yeah, it was done with a brass section. Which was again,
Armstrong Studios at that stage were better set up for that type of recording. Why did they?
I think it was the engineer Roger Savage that was there. That was the main reason it went there. But
and did that work out?
Oh yeah, it did. They were part of the Merv Benton songbook, as it were. His set of recordings are very popular at the time.
We might play a piece on the show. Can you recall one of the tracks' names?
I'll Go Crazy.
If you leave me, I'll you've got to live for yourself and nobody else.
Why believe me? I'm no crazy. Just believe me. I'm no crazy. Cause I love you, love you. Whoa, I love you so much.
Okay, so you actually did move into well into the 60s, but it sounds like you were moving more away from playing in a Thunderbirds type outfit into the more production side of things.
Well, that was the late 60s, and then 70s music didn't do all that much for me, and then I didn't work too much, except in the 80s, about 1983 it was, we started with the All Stars, which was a group of musicians pulled from...
A rotating membership, didn't it?
Well, it did for a while. I mean... Ronnie Chapman was the drummer when I played with him. Henry Borse, who I'd played with in the Thunderbirds, joined the All-Stars as a sax player. Barry Roy, who I knew was the guitar player for the All-Stars in the time that I spent there, and a couple of other guitar players played in it too. And then I think it was in the early 90s, Peter Robinson, who was one of the bass players in the early Thunderbirds, decided we ought to resurrect them and got Harold together and do it. And we formed the Thunderbirds again and did a concert at Preston Town Hall with a 5-piece brass group, which Peter and I wrote charts for the arrangements for this group. And that was very good. I enjoyed doing that.
Yes, I bet you did. And I bet you the audience enjoyed it too.
Yeah. Yeah, there was. We did quite a few shows with that lineup. We were supported very well. Yeah.
You mentioned that in the 60s you did a bit of travelling. The early 60s, you went overseas.
Yeah.
Was that for pleasure? I mean, was that for your own sake, or was that anything work oriented?
Well, it was a family oriented more than anything.
Where did you go?
To Italy. I got married here in Australia to an Italian girl. And I went to Italy.
Was that an eye-opener for you going there at that stage? Because you're basically
wasn't the most pleasant time of my life.
Okay, well, maybe we'll just leave it at that then.
Well, the best thing that came out of that was my eldest son, Peter. He was born here in Australia and he went to Italy and back with me.
Right, okay.
But you spoke before about the two careers going side to side, which was with the aircraft industry and the music at the same time, but the aircraft industry developed into design and drafting, which at that time we did on boards. And then with the National Instrument Company, which was part of the Ansett Group at the time, and they did a lot of defence contract work.
Right.
The Jindabik flightless drone, and they also... And I did a lot of work on the test equipment for the Mirage fighter,
right,
for the guidance system on the Mirage fighter.
Right.
What they call first, second and third line testing equipment for that system. And consequently at that I ended up with a secrecy level associated with that. And it was one of the reasons whether I would have been eligible or not for draft to Vietnam, I don't know that, but this would have...
A protected industry.
Industry. I wouldn't have gone anyway.
Right.
Which the Navy had an interest for me too, because when I was 16, I sat the midshipman's exam for entrance into the Navy as an officer. I think I passed the exam, but they rejected me because of my eyesight, because I had short-sightedness, myopia, since I was 8 years old.
These days it's not an issue.
No, I don't think it would be an issue now, but it was then. And I'd worn glasses since I was 8 years old, because my mother and my teachers were aware of my inability to see properly.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a disappointment, I guess, for you when you were rejected.
Yeah, well, it's... My brushes with the defence establishment amounted to nothing, except that I'd worked on these projects while I was with this instrument company, and then it folded in 1972, and 2 weeks later I was working for the Commonwealth Industrial Gases in their design and development department as a draftsman,
right.
And I was there for 27 years.
Good Lord.
Up until 1999.
That's a lengthy stint.
Yeah, and that was, it's one of the best times of my engineering level of work. I worked for about 8 years on the development of transportable infant incubators.
What is it about that line of work that gave you most pleasure?
In those days, because it was done on a drawing board, it had an artistic aspect.
Right.
Because you were presenting engineering drawings for other people to work to, and it's a means of a communication at a specific level. So, and it was an art form as well. I always like to think of it as an art form.
Yes, you've mentioned that word several times in reference to both music and the drafting. Would you consider yourself as an artistic drawer or a technical drawer? Or both?
No, it was technical drafting, but it had to be done in a way that was not confusing, easy to read. I mean, you were dealing with handwritten wording.
Yes.
And numbers on paper, and it wasn't meant to be confusing. It had to be quite specific.
Yes,
and quite legible.
Yes, yes.
And accurate.
Yes. Were you still drafting or designing when computers started to enter the workplace?
Yes, I was. I wanted to talk a bit about this transportable infant incubator. The one aspect of that was it involved eight years of my life, and at the time the managing director of the Commonwealth Industrial Gases was interested in the development of this thing, and he used to come down to Melbourne and always visited where we were working to look at the development of this. And we ended up with a product called the Thermocot, which could be used on any means of transport to transport premature babies from anywhere at any time, by boat, plane, helicopter, car, truck, anything you can mention it would operate in.
So it was self-contained, was it?
Yes. It won a Prince Philip Design Award.
Well, that must have been a bit of a kudos for you.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you're part of a team, but...
Yeah, I was part of a team. There was an engineer, an electronics engineer named Bob Tyers, who I work with a lot. He was responsible for the electronics circuitry, where I was responsible for the physical design of the whole thing.
Mm.
And that went to printed circuit board layouts, and so I'd get an electronic circuit and have to convert that into a physical reality.
Wow.
So that was very worthwhile. The equipment division of CIG, Commonwealth Industrial Gases, was involved in gas welding, electric welding, industrial safety products and medical products. But the medical product side of it involved major anaesthetic apparatus, heart-lung machines.
Goodness.
The AirViva, which is a hand-operated resuscitation device. And at that time, all the major hospitals in Melbourne had gas systems that were installed and maintained by CIG, and the equipment that went with them.
Mm. So the work was constant and ongoing.
Yes, and the further we got into it, the higher level it became too, because I learned a lot about physiology of infants, because we were dealing with the delivery of oxygen into incubators. The levels of which have to be controlled very precisely because of the problems associated with high levels of oxygen in premature babies.
So you've talked about the design and, the concept, the design. Did it actually go into production?
Oh, very much so.
Because it's not something I think most people in the public would know about.
No.
Heard of.
No. In fact, late last year, I visited the Victorian Ambulance Museum on the other side of Melbourne, and they've got a couple of these Thermocots there because they are in most ambulances.
Okay.
And I'm not sure. I just remember. I remember thinking that I ought to contact the Flying Doctor Service to see if they had them on their aircraft. I believe they would have.
Well, it would make sense. Probably as much sense for them as an ambulance,
yes,
given their situation. Another possible unfair question, but I'll ask it, even if you just reject it. Which gave you most pleasure? the music side of Murray or the technical, innovative side of Murray?
I don't think it was ever a competition. It just sort of happened. Oh, if I was playing music, I did that to the best of my ability. And if I was doing design during the day...
They both gave me more pleasure.
Yes, certainly. Yeah.
Next week, we present the third and final program of The Life and Times of Murray Robertson, where we learn of his work in the USA. Murray also discusses his life on his return to Australia, and in doing so, we learn more about Murray the person. Next week, the conclusion of Murray's story on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.